Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.
Point of View.
On Kaya 959.
With Pimelo Modine.
What's yours?
Welcome and thank you so much for staying with us. So earlier on, I spoke to Gugu about this roundtable that's going to be happening at Mandela Foundation. It's a Malala Fund hosted by Mandela Foundation. And they're here to discuss gender apartheid. It's going to be a public roundtable. And it will be a gathering of Afghan and South African voices on resistance, justice and gender apartheid. And I really want to thank both my guests who are in studio with me tonight. Human rights activists and journalists Horia Mosadik. Thank you so much for being here and welcome to Johannesburg.
Thank you very much.
And Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy at Malala Fund, Saha Halamsai. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having
us. And putting together this entire group of people to come and have a conversation. Let's start with you, Saha, and maybe start with what everybody in South Africa is familiar with by their own lived experiences. Your understanding and definition of apartheid before we get to gender apartheid.
Thank you so much. It's such a privilege and honor to be here in South Africa. The way that we understand apartheid is a legal and political system built to oppress. And it works through control over movement, thought, bodies, and choice, your agency. It works through inclusion, exclusion from education, work, and public life. It's a form of legalized subordination. In other words, using the law to strip people from basic rights and dignity, and denial of dignity. So treating people like they're less than fully human. Mm. That is... You know, that is the framework through which we understand apartheid. Mm.
And I just want to also, as I said, you know, Horia, I want to welcome you here. You specifically want to speak about women in Afghanistan. You yourself are an activist and you want to advocate for gender apartheid. Maybe then contextualize that for us, especially in light of the women in Afghanistan.
Thank you very much. I want to echo what Sahar John already mentioned, is it's such a privilege to be in South Africa and to work with a group of activists, lawyers and judges, and also journalists like yours, who have such a great interest and such a rich experience that from where we can learn. When we speak about gender apartheid in Afghanistan, we are talking about a country that women and girls are being deprived of their very fundamental rights, such as right to education, right to employment, right to economic resources, right to political participation, right to just walk on the streets without being accompanied by a man, right to speak without being criminalized for speaking to someone else. Mm. Right to go to a park, right to go to the gym, right to go to a beauty salon, right to go to a tailor shop. Mm. All these rights have been taken away from the women and girls of Afghanistan and have been criminalized by the Taliban. Since August 2021, Taliban have returned to power under an agreement between the United States and the Taliban. Mm. So as a result of that, they have imposed harsh forms of Sharia law, which imposed on women and girls, and it's depriving women. As I said, girls beyond year 6 are not allowed to go to school. Mm. Women are not allowed to work, except in the medical profession, where women can serve, women doctors can only serve women, and women nurses that can serve other women. That's it. And even in December 2022, Taliban also stopped women aid workers who were delivering humanitarian aid to the other women and families. So under the circumstances, what we are really looking at it, it is not any different from any other apartheid situation that has happened. Mm-hmm. Maybe in South Africa it was an apartheid based on race. Mm-hmm. But in Afghanistan, what we are really seeing it, this is a group that is in a position of power, which is imposing harsh and systematic form of segregation and oppression on another group based on their gender. And this is what we see, and this is what we are here to ask for the support of the South African people, especially activists, lawyers, and the government, also politicians, to support us in our call and to make sure that our word gets to the places where it needs to.
So this is obviously on the back of what is currently being discussed, the draft in the UN of a treaty that will criminalize apartheid. And obviously there are submissions underway and everybody's obviously lobbying for some sort of support. Explain how that fits into that context and why the specific gender apartheid would be something that you feel has to be added on to that definition. In as much as we are all aware of that, the fact that apartheid is being discussed at the moment, why is it important for you to specifically gender apartheid? Why should it be something that is, I don't know if elevated is the right word, or lifted from the pages above other apartheids? Let me just explain that for me.
So there are treaties that prohibit genocide, war crimes, and torture, but there is no dedicated international treaty that defines and punishes crimes against humanity, including gender apartheid. And that's one of the most significant gaps in international law. Legal experts have been working for decades to close that gap. And we find ourselves in this unique situation where that is changing. In November 2024, the United Nations Sixth Committee, which is its legal committee, decided to move formal negotiations for Crimes Against Humanity treaty, a treaty that civil society, academics, and states have been pushing for a long time, and Afghan women and lawyers and activists and their allies have been a big part of that. And now for the first time, there is an opportunity to include gender apartheid in that legal framework. And the reason that matters is because gender apartheid is not just about individual violations. We're not talking about discrimination. We're not talking about the things we find in most contexts. It's about a regime of power that uses gender as a tool of domination. It is what is happening in Afghanistan is, it's not about culture, it's not about religion. It is the very logic that informs the form of governance the Taliban are imposing on women and girls. And we don't have a law that says that that is a crime. And it is a crime. And so whilst we are, we are doing this work to do everything that we can to have some form of accountability for what is happening to Afghan women and girls, to push against the political system designed to erase half of the population from public life, to really name this as state violence. But it's not just about Afghan women and girls. It's about creating an accountability tool in the international legal system that says that no regime can ever again create a system of oppression that dominates only on the basis of gender. We just don't have that protection.
I like the fact that, this is not only about Afghani women, because I'm sure there are other regions, and I wonder whether you're in talks with them and or collaborating with them, Saudi Arabia, Iran and the like, Pakistan in some ways. So are you collaborating in formulating your submissions in that regard?
We're working with legal experts who are really taking care of that piece of it. What we're doing, and the reason we're here with this delegation that brings together a really diverse group of Afghan women activists, journalists, storytellers, advocates, is we're trying to build a liberation movement across borders. First, we really want to build deep networks of solidarity in the global south, in the global majority. And alongside that, we're working with legal experts who are looking at what does the next steps of the negotiations looks like, what can we do to make sure that gender is included in the draft treaties.
Yeah. When you say apartheid in South Africa, everybody stops to listen, because obviously we have our own experience of apartheid. And I think they will be asking the question, how does this differ to our own definition of apartheid? Help us understand how we can, support one another. gender apartheid in light of our own mission of trying to get justice for the peoples of this country who we know until now still have not, mm-hmm. many have not gotten justice, yes, especially internationally. And maybe in a way, you know, that would be the conversation from South Africans. Help us understand how we can be partners in this, and how does this assist our own plight of trying to get justice for South Africans?
That is such an excellent question, and I think one that we've been thinking about quite a lot. I think our goal here is not to draw sort of false equivalences between what is, you know, the South African experience of apartheid and what is happening in Afghanistan today. I think what we really want to do is ask the question of, what does liberation look like when we build it across borders? What does it look like when we shift centers of power from the global north to the global majority? That is a big part of what we're doing. And what's been really interesting in the conversations we've been having with our South African friends and allies is the fact that the sort of gender dimension of racial apartheid was never fully addressed, and their experience of that unique harm that they suffered and the space to have that conversation as South Africans didn't really exist. And so that's been a really powerful conversation to be a part of. So how do we build that together, and how do we draw solidarity and create the space to have those, you know, to create new spaces to have those conversations?
Harriet, what would solidarity look like for the women in Afghanistan?
Well, solidarity means in different shapes and forms. Like, for example, we, as Sarah already mentioned, like when we are having other women and men from across the continent, they are expressing their support, they are standing with us, they are marching with us, they are going at the back of the United Nations doors, and they are standing with us. Like, this is how support looks like. And same, you know, like so many activists from so many countries, they have expressed their solidarity, their empathy with us. And this is, I think, what we are really looking is that we need to build upon that. We need to raise awareness about what's happening on Afghanistan. Like, women are being stripped of their very fundamental rights. Mm. Like, if a girl cannot study beyond year 6, for example, so many girls who were graduated from year 6 last year, they didn't want to graduate. They deliberately failed themselves. They gave blank papers to the teachers just to stay in school. This is so heartbreaking. Like, I, as a mother, as a woman who spent my first, when I was very young, I was under the first era of the Taliban, mm-hmm. in the 1990s. I was stripped of my right to continue with my education. I was a university student. And it is so heartbreaking to see that the history repeats itself. And now, being the mother of 3 daughters, I can see the same thing happening to my daughters, who are being deprived of their right to education, and they are confined in their own homes. Their voices are criminalized. If they walk out of their home, they are criminalized. I was beaten by the Taliban back in 1990s under their first rule, simply for daring to lift out my burqa to see the color of a cloth, the color of a fabric, because I couldn't see it from behind my burqa screen. And now the same thing is happening to our daughters. This is the most heartbreaking thing, that you can see that how history repeats itself. This is why for us, solidarity means that we raise awareness and people understand what we are going through and how they can support us, how they can be our voices, how they can knock on their governments to tell them to stand by us and to support us and to talk to the United Nations. We don't have those seats in the Security Council. We don't have those seats in General Assembly of the United Nations. We don't have those leverage to meet with the presidents, with the ministers, but your governments do. So we want those people to talk to their MPs, to talk to their politicians, and to make our voices being heard across the globe, and to understand what women and girls in Afghanistan are going through now.
There were obviously commitments made to peoples of your nation when the Taliban came in. Do you feel let down by those nations?
Of course, you know, like even at the time when the whole shambolic peace talks were happening between the United States and the Taliban, we kept warning on and on, not only just the United States, but the entire members of the international community. We were meeting with the embassies, we were meeting with the ambassadors, with the politicians, with the EU members, with the United States, and we kept telling them, don't trust the Taliban. You know, we lived under the Taliban, and we know in the past 20 years, since 2001 till 2021, like, the Taliban were the only source of insecurity, killings, suicide attacks, damaging and destroying our infrastructures, attacking schools, killing teachers, poisoning students, killing female police officers, attacking women politicians. Their whole identity is built upon being anti-woman movement. So don't trust them. And then we were told, oh, there are like-minded Taliban and hardline Taliban. These like-minded Taliban are now very different, and they have promised that they will allow women to girls to go to school and women go to work. But we were proved right on, and they were proved wrong. And still, you know, we cannot get our words, you know, across them. Like, whenever we speak to those politicians, whenever we tell them we have warned you about that, yeah, you are right. Yeah, we are still talking to the Taliban. Unfortunately, what we are really seeing the Taliban, like, if you ask Afghans themselves, we are not looking into the Taliban as a homegrown, homogeneous military group. They have been imposed on us. You know, this group was created as a result of the Cold War between Russia and the United States. They are the product of 20 years of privatization of the war in Afghanistan by the very military groups and companies that were operating inside Afghanistan. Like, they are the result of the drug cartels who want to control the whole drug economy. They are not a homegrown, because what Taliban are doing in Afghanistan, I am an Afghan. My father is an Afghan. My grandmother, my mother, and, you know, my seven generations before all of Afghans, none of them can recognize what Taliban are doing if it is part of the Afghan culture or religion. Nothing that they do is representing Afghanistan, Afghan culture, and Afghan religion.
The draft submissions, I mean, it's a very small window to try and get gender apartheid included in this definition in being criminalized. Outside of that tool, what other kind of mechanisms would there be, or have you at least attempted to use in support of the women in Afghanistan or places like Afghanistan?
The movement to address what the Taliban are doing in Afghanistan is broad, and there is really an all-tools approach that the movement is taking. Our focus is on gender apartheid codification, but there are lots of others. There is the case of the ICJ against the Taliban under CEDAW. There's loads of documentation efforts underway to really record what is happening inside the country, to see how that can be used in future cases. And Afghan women are taking huge risks to do those sorts of documentations in a place where there is a completely closed information environment, where freedom, you know, there is no freedom of movement. That becomes super important. There's efforts to, you know, to tell the stories of what is happening in Afghanistan. One of the things that we're constantly struck by is how little actually emerges from Afghanistan that sort of lands in the rest of the world about the daily reality of what it means to be an Afghan woman or a girl under this system. And one of the big parts of that is telling those stories, making sure those voices get out. And for us, it's all connected. Yeah. It's all looking at the different mechanisms, but also shaping the narratives and telling the stories of both what is happening, but also of resistance. There is lots of resistance inside the country.
Apart from what we're hearing Horia say, we are all of us in a very patriarchal systems, political systems around the world, essentially. And I'm just curious about, I mean, we here in the continent know just how many nations are resisting, even just the acknowledgement of LGBTQI plus communities. That's an ongoing fight. how much support are you getting from other international communities, and how difficult is it? Because as Horia said, you know, sometimes you bring this up and they say, yes, we know, we're still talking to them. And I don't know how long you've been having that conversation, but not much is moving.
It's such a good question. I think there's resistance. Of course, there's resistance, especially when you put gender rights on the table. There's always resistance. But this movement has really gained so much support at the same time. There was just one example. In January, Malala went to Islamabad to deliver a keynote speech at the World Muslim League conference with the president of OIC and a number of OIC nations represented. What emerged from that was the Islamabad Declaration, where these states got together and published a declaration that they signed their names to that said, what the Taliban are doing in Afghanistan is not cultural and it's not a part of Islam. So there is a lot of support in the region. There's a lot of support internationally that we're building. And I really believe that the way that this movement is mobilizing and growing, that by the time we get to the preparatory committee meetings early next year, we will have brought together a pretty strong group of states. But no state's voice matters more than South Africa. And there's a reason for that. I think South Africa has a moral and historical authority on the issue of apartheid. And it's not just about politics. It's about principles. So people really look to South Africa and South Africa's position on gender apartheid, which is why we're here. We really want to work with the government of South Africa to gain support for our efforts to codify gender apartheid.
You obviously know about our ICJ case. We are under a lot of fire for that. And obviously the focus has been primarily for many South Africans, the lived experience of Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder whether, you know, you've also been able to bring them to the fore in your support for codifying gender apartheid.
It's a really good question. I think we are being incredibly thoughtful and deliberate about how we bring our Palestinian sisters into this conversation. It's a really difficult time to have these conversations given the kind of horror they're living through. But there are efforts underway, you know, privately, small efforts to really think about how do we build this movement with our Palestinian sisters. Mm-hmm. So we are doing a little bit of that.
So there's obviously going to be public engagements, two, one at Mandela Foundation and one at UCT. And what kind of engagements are you looking to have with South Africans, you know, in terms of what are you looking to get from them? Hari, let me just start from you.
Well, we really hope, like, first of all, as Sahar already mentioned, like, we are really hoping to not only just raise awareness about what happens in Afghanistan, but also to seek the support and you know, to make sure that, you know, what we are doing is, you know, it's also getting the support of South Africa. Because as Sarah already mentioned, you know, like, there are so many countries that we could go to. Mm. But from our perspective, you know, only South Africa has that moral authority to stand with us, to support us, to give us the green light, because even like we ourselves feel empty if we don't have the support of South Africa. Like, I think this means so much to us, like, throughout our struggle, because whenever you speak about gender apartheid, whether it's racial, whether it's gender, you know, South Africa comes first, and you have that moral authority, and we are looking up to you, and we are here to also to learn from you, to learn how the 40 years of a struggle, how those decades, and after the decades being let down by so many countries, by so many organizations, how you still manage to keep that, you know, because we are just 4 years in this fight, and we are already feeling, wow, how long we can really go. And this is why we are here, to look at you, to get the strength, to get the support, and to have the moral authority, you know.
And Sahar,
just maybe from your perspective with the little, I don't know how much time you've had to engage, are you gaining anything from the South African public and the NPOs that you're meeting with and the various people that you are engaging with?
You know, one of the most incredible things, we've been here for a day, but one of the most incredible things that really has been so powerful is how different the conversation is here.
Mm.
It is just such a different, it's, we don't have to explain our pain and suffering in the way that we have to in every other context we've been in. We feel, honestly, we feel so, you know, we feel at home here in the way that we're able to talk about some of the things that we're having to resist and address. And really, we're here to start a conversation. And that's what's been really beautiful and powerful about being here and the folks that we've met. It's just the approach is so different. The questions are so different. It's so much more powerful and thoughtful. And I would say if there's one thing that we want to do here, aside from, you know, gaining the support of the South African government for our efforts to codify gender apartheid, we really just want to start a conversation. We want to start a conversation. We want to connect, and we want to learn.
And when you know, you speak of resistance in some parts of the mm-hmm. world, or whenever you have engagements in elsewhere, what is the resistance?
I think one of the things that Afghan women have had to deal with, you know, a lot for the last 20 decades especially, is the way that our rights and freedoms have been instrumentalized by foreign powers mm-hmm. to justify various actions inside Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So the sort of the freedom of Afghan women was used to justify 20 years of presence inside the country. Women's rights were tokenized, they were instrumentalized, but of course it was never actually about the freedoms and rights of Afghan women. So that is the first thing that we're always having to grapple with. And I think the collapse of the republic, the Doha process that they sort of disguised as a peace deal but was really a withdrawal agreement, those were results of political decisions. Political decisions were made to abandon this country, and not just abandon the country. The vast majority of Afghans in the lead up to the Doha talks did not want Western presence in Afghanistan. Mm. You know, they wanted their country back. But what they didn't want was a process that gave power to the Taliban, that literally rolled out the red carpet to the Taliban and said, you can take over. And there was so much resistance. There was so much resistance. Women organized inside the country, outside the country. They wrote pieces in the press. They did research. They did, I mean, every type of resistance you can imagine to try and really address this issue, Afghans did. But they were ignored. Afghan women, when they consistently said Taliban 2.0 is not going to emerge, were called warmongers. They were told, you just want to keep this, what they started calling the forever war, going. And the way that whole process was conducted, with the Taliban getting everything they asked for at every step of the way, without representatives from the government, without civil society, without women, you know, we knew then that the country was going to be abandoned. But these were political decisions.
And I mean, your rational understanding of why those negotiations flourished and found the kind of expression that they do now, with the Taliban really having carte blanche. How do you make sense of that, Haria?
Well, to be honest, I think at the beginning it was so difficult for me to understand that these countries, especially Western countries, from one hand, they go and bomb other places because they want to bring democracy. And then from the other hand, the same countries, you're just going and sleeping in the same bed with the terrorist groups that once they were bombing and using it as an excuse to attack some countries. For me, it was so difficult to understand how the UN Security Council could put Taliban as a terrorist group at one point and delist them at another point. I think we went through series of emotions to understand how this whole imperialistic system is working, how these Western countries are so double standard in defining who is a good human rights abuser and who is a bad human rights abuser. But now, I think after those years, after at least this, you know, nearly 4 years, we are in this situation to, you know, pull ourselves together, to stay united and to understand, you know, where we need to go, where we need to fight, where we need to ask for support. But I think the whole thing, it was as a shock. I think for so many of us, it was so much eye-opening also to also understand, you know, how the whole international politics is working, but where we can get our call for the codification of gender apartheid, which are the genuine friends who can stand with us. These are individuals and some of the countries and you know, some of the politicians, like they are coming from all walks of life, you know, how they can have a solidarity with us in order to make sure that gender apartheid is recognized as a crime under the international law and it is being codified. Because what happened in Afghanistan, we are sure the way that the whole, you know, international political arena is now moving, I think it may repeat in some other situations as well. Like, let's not also dismiss, you know, what happened, you know, in other parts of the world, or what's happening in other parts of the world. So we really need, I think we are racing against the time, but still, you know, I think for us, it is really important to understand, you know, which doors are the genuine supporters that we can knock and ask for the support.
Yeah. You're a journalist. What's your lived experience like as a woman living in Afghanistan right now? What becomes of those women who are journalists in Afghanistan?
Well, since Taliban have returned in August 2021, almost all women-run media have been shut, except for very few that were surviving over those years. But then one after the other were targeted. Their staff were attacked and the radio stations were closed down, or the, you know, other publications that they had. Over 90% of women journalists, they lost their jobs, and only the rest 10% are the ones who can just go and sneak and do some background work without being able to be seen, without being able to speak, without being able to announce that they are a journalist. Like, the other 10% are working underground. They are like underground journalists. Like, there are the media that is now run inside Afghanistan, they are all under the severe Taliban control and censorship. For every day, all the media outlets, especially digital media such as radio or television, they have to send their program to the Ministry of Information and Culture for approval. The guests that you're inviting, they have to be approved by the Ministry of Information and Culture. And then for the women journalists, of course, there is no space and there is nowhere where they can express, where they can, you know, report or to do what they were used to do just before 15th of August 2021.
I've got a question here coming from our platform, a listener. Wendy Isaacs asks, and I think you've responded partly to this, what is your guest's understanding of the origins of the term apartheid? And the second part of this is, will the other crimes in the draft treaty not cover what is happening to women in Afghanistan? Will the crime of persecution not deal with this appropriately?
I think there are... that's a really excellent question. I think there are important similarities between what is happening in Afghanistan today and what happened under racial apartheid system in South Africa. And I think that's what we need to address. There is nothing that exists on the books and in the international legal system that addresses that. Gender persecution doesn't address that. We're talking about addressing a system of governance that is designed to dominate. The whole logic of it is dominating one group over another, in this case men dominating women. We're talking about a system of power designed to control and entrench the superiority of one group over another. And they both rely on law to continue that inequality. We don't have anything on the books that addresses that. And that is part of why we're doing this work.
Well, thank you both for coming in and, you know, for having this really honest conversation. I wish you all the best with your tour this entire time you're here. And do people come to these dialogues? Are they invited? How does it work?
I believe the event of the Nelson Mandela Foundation, there might still be some places.
So they can go to the website and have a look there and all of that. But appreciate you coming through, especially coming into studio. Really
thank you so much for having us.
And thank you. And I hope you enjoy yourself here in the country for the few days that you're going to be here. Hore, do you still go back to Afghanistan?
I can't, unfortunately. If I go, I will get arrested or I will disappear. I don't know. God knows what will happen to me.
It was something that I wondered about.
Yeah, because before Taliban have taken power, I have been receiving so many death threats.
Your family still there?
I have some family, not close family. But
well, thank you for making time for us this evening. Horia Mossadegh is a human rights activist and journalist as well as Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy at Malala Fund, Saha Halaimzai. Thank you for coming through and really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's a minute to nine.
Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.